metros de altura sobre el nivel del mar y los estudios intergalácticos de la pradera. Alteramos tu locus cerúleo calentando tus sinapsis con rejuvenecedoras ondas de radio. Esto calienta tu cerebro unos sabrosos y tostaditos 365 grados, manteniendo la avalancha de estatismo fuera de tu cabeza. ¿Lo sienten? ¿Funciona? ¿Lo sienten?
Sí, sí, sí.
Sí,
sí. Sí.
De yes. Verdad. Los Freedom Fins están cubiertos por una licencia BIPCOT de no gobierno. Esto permite que todo el mundo lo use excepto los gobiernos. Aprende más en BIPCOT.org.
That's okay. Awesome. So, thank you.
That's awesome.
That's Hugo, and this is Michael Dean, and we got MK Lords and Randy England.
Hi.
What's your last name, Hugo?
My last name is Gonzalez, so it's a pretty common name here in Mexico and Latin America.
Yep.
Yep.
And he's in Mexico City, and we're doing good, and I'm having a button sale. I'm trying to get rid of all the old Fiends button designs to make way for the new Fiends design, so $5 for 10 buttons until I run out, so write to me, tell me if I still have them, PayPal or Bitcoin, $5, you'll get 10 buttons, and I want to sell them all because I have a bunch of expenses now, too. I just bought a... Among other things, I just had to buy a $500 vacuum cleaner that, like, has special filters so it doesn't pump the dust back in the air for me. Wow. All sorts of stuff for my health. Got someone coming over tomorrow to bulldoze the backyard, get rid of all the plants, kill everything with fire. And, man, we are broadcasting from Feene, New Hampshire, F-E-E-N-E. See, what happened was, like, the... There's so much whining going on in Keene, New Hampshire, that the Freedom Fiends had to go in, like, Jade Helm style and do a military takeover and put everybody into libertarian re-education work camps because they need to know. Everyone there except pretty much, like, you know, I think it's Ian Freeman and Derek J. Like, everybody else we had to put into re-education camps. So we changed the name from Keene to Feene, F-E-E-N-E. And, Cantwell is at the bottom of a pit with a bunch of black guys throwing meat to him. Because he called a black guy the N-word today. Do you guys see that on Twitter? That was just tasteless. Yeah, I think he's a cop. I'm starting to think he's a cop again.
And
yeah. Speak up, son.
Childish.
Yeah.
Kind of pathetic. This is like a grown man saying these things on the internet. Yeah. Like, it's sad.
Yeah. You can't look because he blocked you, but, yeah.
I have ways around that, but...
Yep. You have ways around that.
Not anymore.
Yeah. All right.
Weirdly, people will send me stuff. I don't know why. Like, I'll just get, like, random screen caps, random messages. Like, oh, did you see this? It's like, oh, I didn't want to see that, but...
Sure. I know. I didn't want
to
see
there.
That.
It's there. I didn't need to see that, but it's all good.
All right. I've checked in and said everything I can. I've spoken as much as my voice will allow me to. I'm going to go nebulize some steroids for my lungs, not the good kind of steroids, not the ones that pump you up. But have a good time, you guys. Have a great show. And
take care.
Keep rocking it out in the free world for liberty, y'all. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, good night, Michael.
Take care.
Worms.
Yeah, feel better.
Worms.
All
well,
right.
Hey, guys. Somebody brought up a topic about some mother who is defying a court order for not circumcising her child. It wasn't me. I don't know who generated that, but speak up there. Who was?
Yeah,
was that
I can talk about it. That was me.
What about that?
So this is a woman in Florida who went through a divorce with her husband, and one of the agreements that she signed, this was a separation deal that she signed 3 years ago, by the way, and she consented to have the boy circumcised, and then later she changed her mind because she believes it's, you know, an unnecessary procedure, and he's trying to force her to now get the boy circumcised. He's 4 years old now, and she's resisting the court order to do so. So she kind of, she was staying at a shelter for a while to avoid having to enforce this. She was basically ordered to take the child to a doctor to get him circumcised, and she refused to do that. So this kind of brings up a lot of interesting ideas about, you know, are your children your property, or, you know, can the state force you, or can another parent use the state to force you to get your child circumcised if you don't want him circumcised? So what are y'all's thoughts on this?
Well, I myself, I'm against circumcision in general. I consider it mutilation, and that's a position that many libertarians are taking recently. And you know, there's both camps, but in any circumstance, it's very revealing that a court order would mandate a procedure on your child. It's I don't know. It's surreal. It's I mean, I can understand when people get mandates for, I don't know, a fine or something with your property. But that's the very essence of you, your own body. You own your own body. And that child, right, even though he's four, he owns his own body.
It's an unnecessary procedure, from what I understand, too. And this is a weird thing. The ex-husband testified in court, and he said that submitting his child to the surgical procedure is just the normal thing to do. Like, that was his reason given. It wasn't like, oh, it's better to do it from a medical perspective or anything like that. It was just like, everyone else is doing it, so I might as well submit my child to this unnecessary medical procedure.
It doesn't sound like he had to be very articulate. But did you also mention that the woman is sitting in jail?
Yeah. She was arrested for this.
Well,
she spent 3 months in hiding, defying this court order, and they did end up catching her and throwing her in jail for. It's such a sad story.
Well, let me play devil's advocate, because it's neither one of you guys are going to, and play the flip side just a little bit here first. Of course, you can play this like, oh, a judge had to decide whether the child should be circumcised or not, and the judge said it has to be done. That's not what I read when I read this. I read that there was a divorce or separation of some kind with various agreements of whatever kinds between the parties voluntarily agreed to, and one of the agreements was that the child should be circumcised. So this is the enforcement of a contract. It's not a judge. I mean, the judge is, if you took it to the judge and said, it's your job to decide, you know, the judge probably has to just look at the contract, and unless the contract is unconscionable, enforce the contract. Now, throwing the woman in jail, that seems to me, you know, overreaching. But the fact of the supercision, I think you, Hugo, you said you disagree and don't think that you should do circumcision of babies or you know, little kids. But you also recognize that there are some arguments on the other side, some medical arguments, health arguments, and things like that. And in fact, there are reasons on both sides. Now, my feeling on that is that there are not compelling enough reasons on either side to have the state enforce its will on the parents.
If
they decide one way or the other.
I did some research on that, and doctors are really tiptoeing around the issue. It's a very delicate thing for them to, you know, just give out an opinion on. And they will never say that it has to be done.
Right.
They will never say, if you ask them straight up, does my child need a circumcision, they will say no. And there has been some kind of consensus between pediatricians or something to do with the AMA, and they are very careful about what they're saying. There's a contract thing, and I don't know, an arrangement for a divorce, it just sounds very, very odd to me. It's like, I'm keeping the foreskin, you're keeping the child, and it's really, I mean, right. you're splitting your things because you're getting a divorce. And
goodness.
I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah, like King Solomon, you know, split the child in half and I'll get the foreskin.
There you go. Well, so
anyway, that's an aesthetic consideration.
It kind of highlights another problem too, and that's the state being involved in marriage, and but also this kind of broader problem of when two people do decide to get a divorce, you know, how do you enforce these contracts? How do you, especially if like the knowledge changes, like if you sign a contract and then, you know, a few months go by or a year goes by and you find out new information that makes you believe that maybe you shouldn't have signed that contract. How does that kind of play into it? I mean, I understand from a legal perspective, that's a contract that has to be enforced. I would think
well, the court would look contract, at it as... Not if the contract is found to be void because you did not enter into it with full knowledge or voluntarily or something like that. I mean, you can void a contract. But
it seems like it's more done out of bitterness in this case. Like it's just divorces are really, really bad. And it's a totally, it's like he's just trying to go after her just to have, you know, another thing to just keep, you know, poking at or something. I don't know. It's a sad situation.
The other thing that, you know, I don't know if they said about it in the article or not. I mean, like, was the father Jewish or something, or was that another article? You know, you get into the religious cultural things there. So, I mean, the father could very well not be insisting upon this out of spite. It could be he could very well be sincere in this particular issue, I guess. But I still think that the judge looked at it purely as an enforcement of a contract. And the first thing the judge does is decides whether the contract is valid, whether it was entered into knowingly and voluntarily. And if the contract is valid, I think the judge's job probably is to enforce it, or at least order it enforced. I don't know. Like I said, mm-hmm. If I was a judge, I do not see how I could throw anybody in jail over this.
Randy, would you say this contract is pretending to bind a third party? This third party being the child? Because I cannot engage
I don't think
so. Enter into a contract with you that tries to bind MK.
No, but a child, an infant, and this kid's older now, mm-hmm. like 4 years old or something, they're still totally in the care of their parents. And so the child is really not, they're a consideration, but their decision is not so relevant right now.
Well.
Although,
yeah, I guess that's how the state would see it, yeah.
Well, that's how anybody would. If it was your kid, you're not going to let them tell you whether they're going to run the street or not.
Uh-huh. Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now. Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
I don't know how much we talked over into the break or not, but before we went out, we were talking about the issue of, if a child, what rights would a child have in terms of deciding whether there should be a circumcision? Because I think in the case that MK was reading earlier, the child is not an infant. This child is 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think about that?
Well, first... I don't know. You bring that up, and I'm thinking: is there the possibility of asking the child, because he's kind of old now?
Yeah, this is tricky because you think he would have enough of a consciousness to know that, like, you know, something medical or something surgical is going to be happening to him in that area. But I don't know that he may have the full understanding of the procedure, you know, like it's kind of a weird thing. And how much, you know, yeah, I wonder if there's any kind of extra fear kind of put on there, like if the woman's maybe very, very anti-circumcision, which I am too. I mean, like, I don't see any real medical need for it. But if she's, you know, scared the child about it because she's angry at the dad who's trying to force her, you know, I always wonder about, especially with contentious divorces like this, it's just been spread out over years now. You know, I kind of wonder how much of that fear is like a psychological fear, which, I mean, I would be afraid too if I was a child and had to go through that.
But if you were,
so yeah, what are the child's rights in this?
A good mom, though, if she was forced to go through with it, would, I'm sure, at least try not to pass on additional trauma to the child.
Hopefully.
But yes. I mean, I remember, yeah, you know, when I was a little kid, I mean, one of the, I don't have a whole lot of memories from when I was four, but I do remember being terrified of getting things like shots and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if anyone had said anything like a shot to me, I mean, I'd just run. And it would be the same for, like, getting cut or something mm-hmm. like that. I think during the break, you know, we're mentioning normally this is done to an infant, which while there would be, you know, some physical pain, I assume even if you had an anesthetic when it was happening, it would be hurt. It would hurt like after any minor surgical procedure, it's going to be sore, but the psychic suffering, you know, would not be there with the infant, but it certainly could be with a four-year-old.
Mm-hmm. I actually have a friend who told me he was circumcised when he was about five, and he told me he remembers he got very scared, even though he had anesthesia.
Yeah.
And he felt very weird for some days afterwards. Of course, you just wake up or you look down there and you're missing a chunk of what you used to have.
That's got to be really traumatic. Traumatizing.
Yeah.
Because you've gotten used to it by then. You know, the child has gotten used to, you know, them being physically a certain way. So, yeah, it could be even more traumatizing.
I remember feeling this betrayal sometimes for minor things. When I got a shot, and I remember I was like six or seven, and I felt very, very betrayed by my parents because they were taking me there so for someone else to hurt me. I mean, I didn't know any better, but it felt bad, and it was like my parents were holding me while somebody was poking me with a needle. So it is nevertheless very traumatic, even though they could tell you and explain something to you.
Right. And back in the old days, a hypodermic needle was as big around as a pencil lead.
Yeah, this was 30 years ago.
For me, it was longer than that. But I'm told that I put up such a fight, my mother just quit telling me before I had to go get a shot, which was probably smart, because that way I only suffered for the 2 minutes between when I was told and when it was over, as opposed to the 2 weeks leading up to it. So actually, it was a mercy.
You're not going to be agonizing over,
now,
over
I,
it.
No, I still haven't forgiven her, okay? But, you know, it's not as bad. Mother's Day is coming up. I'm still going to take her out for dinner. We just had it.
We just had it, but
I'll have to take her out. Yeah.
There we go. But, yeah, I hated the doctor. Yeah.
And no kidding. Well, hey, and now Hugo, there was another one that was a similar to this issue. Was it the? Is that the one I was thinking of? Was it in Israel?
Yeah, it was in Israel, which makes more sense than it being in Florida, but. It's yeah, Florida man. You know, we could just start a Florida man news segment with that.
I think I have to.
News.
I kind of feel obligated to.
Yeah, Florida man forces wife to circumcise the boy. She refuses. He puts her in jail.
Florida woman is the hero of the story.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Anti-war, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Yum, yum. Yum, yum. Ow. Yum, yum. Ow. Woo.
Beans.
Hello, Freedom Fiends, and we're back. And Randy, we were talking before the break, we were talking about another case of this divorced parents fighting over their son's body parts after circumcision. And we have an article that talked about a similar case in Israel. So a rabbinical court in Netanya, I hope I'm saying right, in Israel, this week forced a divorced woman to facilitate the performance of a Jewish circumcision for her son. During the divorce process, the husband requested that the regional rabbinical courts compel his wife to give their son a legal circumcision. And the court accepted his request. So, Randy, MK, what do you got to say about this? It's in Israel, and it's not a civil court. It's some kind of religious court. I was told that religious courts were a bad thing. I'm told that every day. You know, Sharia law and all that.
Well, I'm glad that I guess I wouldn't have to submit to something like this, like a rabbinical court. Or like if I were going to church here, I would hope that I wouldn't be forced to use a kind of religious type court, because the woman in the case was arguing that this matter belongs in family court, and they pretty much just rejected that. The rabbinical judges disagreed with her and basically said, you know, your son is our property. And she's saying, you know, my son's not your property. You don't have jurisdiction over him. And that's a scary position to be in, because I would hope that if you did have religious courts, they would be voluntary and people, you know, could opt out of them. If this woman was going to a synagogue and they have some type of court system there, if she does find it to be unjust, that she could opt out of it. But I don't know what the exact procedure is here. What do you think, Randy?
Well, you know, I don't know how much power a rabbinical court has, if they have the power to assess a fine and take it from you or punish you in some other way, like, say, throw you in jail, which is a possibility. At least that's what happened in that other case. But, you know, there have been religious courts. Back in the Middle Ages, this was the thing. And actually, the religious courts were typically thought of as you'd much rather be in front of a European ecclesiastical court than in front of the secular courts. And we still have them today when things finally changed in England, and then, you know, we have the English system here in the United States. What they called ecclesiastical courts in Europe are now called courts of equity in the United States. And, excuse me, courts of equity, the word equity, you know, suggests like fairness in that. You still might file a lawsuit instead of filing it, as they say, in law. You file it in equity. I don't know if there's any actual separate equity courts, but there is equity law in most states in the United States. And you basically are going in and saying, well, we know that the law, you know, says this, the black letter law says this, but we would like this court to act in fairness, in equity. And so we still have the remnants of those courts. And in fact, those courts tend to be if you want to use the word fairer, they are fairer. But it's been a long time since you actually had a church court. And I don't think it's ever happened in this country that a church court had any power at all except through a voluntary agreement. I don't know. And I don't know about this case in Israel, what their power is. It says that they can assess a financial penalty, I think.
Yeah, they said they were going to impose a fine, but that raises a question. How are they supposed to enforce it? If she says, you know, I'm not going to pay this money, well, what would they do to her? She could be banned from the synagogue, and I think that would be a bad thing if you're a religious person, especially if you're Jewish in Israel.
There's probably some form of pressure, some form of maybe shaming or guilting of some kind, I would think. At the very least, I mean, it would be hard to physically enforce something like this without, you know, being a little bit aggressive. So what I think is kind of strange is the judges basically said, you know, this is a surgery that's conducted on every Jewish baby 8 days or older around the world for thousands of years. And then they say, therefore, when one of the parents demands it, the other party may not prevent it unless a medical danger can be proven. That's just kind of like not even a real segue there. It's just like they've done this for thousands of years. Therefore, one parent can force the other one to do it. And the whole medical danger thing, whether it can be proven, I mean, I guess worst case scenario is, you know, you sever the penis and that leads to a really bad thing that can't be reconstructed, really. I mean, that's happened several times before, from what I understand, the little bit of research.
It happens to a few babies. It happens to a few babies a year all over the world. I don't know. I read that somewhere around 5-10 babies.
I remember Lorena Bobbitt.
Get really bad. Well,
that was.
Yeah, she was not a professional in circumcision. She made a rather botched job of it.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, I remember that. So, Randy,
it's not dangerous, though. I guess it's not technically recognized as a dangerous procedure. Typically, people are very skilled who are doing it, but it's still like it seems just so unnecessary. And again, unless a problem develops later,
I'd like to know how many accepted forms of body modification are there for religious reasons. Because, you know, we see all those, there's a ton of them. There's scaring, and there's neck lengthening, and there's what do you call, there's
foot
a female.
Foot binding.
There's foot binding. And female mutilation, genital mutilation, you know, that's funny how we can say mutilation in the case of female mutilation, but in the male case, it's called something different. But generally, what it comes down to for me is how many other kinds of mutilations are accepted, and if we accept them in the West, why the only one, the circumcision is the only one. That struck me as odd too, and I don't know. It's just it looks barbaric to me. So, but that's my own judgment. I know all those foot binding and all the scaring and all those procedures are backed by centuries of tradition, which is the argument here. It's been done for centuries.
I think it would be very hard in Israel to get many people horrified at the prospect of a circumcision.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's been
so long.
Well,
because it's a spiritual thing, too.
Yeah, it's a religious thing. It's a cultural thing. It's so accustomed to it. And, you know, the idea, you mentioned the danger of it. Every medical procedure has a degree of danger to it. Mm-hmm. But most of them, you know, like this, or, you know, I guess people, do they still get their tonsils out? You know, they're low, but you can still show a certain level of mortality. I mean, maybe one in a million.
That's true. Yeah.
But it happens.
And they will make you sign the form, right?
But see, that's the same thing. Though. I mean, that comes with every vaccination, too. I mean, a certain number of kids with vaccinations are going to suffer. I mean, you know, watch a drug commercial on TV TV and they talk about, you know, death or serious physical injury, you know, may come from using this aspirin. I mean, there's nothing you can do that doesn't have a mortality rate, including getting in your car and driving to the store.
Right. Well, I guess the difference in this case would be that if you don't get circumcised, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of medical danger either.
Yes, but in Israel, like if, they might poke fun at you.
right, of course. In the locker room. They might. Yeah, it would be. Right, it would be. It might be a jarring, like, cultural experience as a young man. Like,
they do explain it here, and they say, I'm going to read just a little bit of this, and this is the religious argument. It says the circumcision is the sign, the mark, the distinguishing detail of the Jewish identity of every Jew, wherever he may be, and whatever his spiritual state. An uncircumcised Jewish identity is incomplete and defective. So that's the damage that's being claimed here. If this boy weren't circumcised, he would be an incomplete Jew in Israel. So, well, I think there's place for some kind of social damage. I don't know.
Yeah, there could be some social damage from that.
He'll be bullied in the locker room.
Yeah. Man, just can't win either way with this stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
No. Once it grows up, he can still have it done.
You're back
to that ooh factor, you know.
The ouchy factor. But, it's kind of interesting.
You were talking before about the equity courts, and you were saying there weren't many, or if any at all, religious courts in America, and I have a doubt about that. What about the Salem trials and those witch hunts and those things that happened?
I meant in the United States. I didn't mean the early colonial times. They had a lot of different systems back then. And some of them, you know, like the Salem trials and that, I'm not sure if they actually had a real secular system or might have been purely religious. And I'm no expert on that sort of thing, but there you have a religious thing. And I don't know how those were conducted, if they just said, oh, we find that you're a witch, and then they take you out and burn you. I'm not sure if that's how it was done. I know that during the Inquisition in Europe, in, say, some of the harsher places like Spain, kings were using the accusation of heresy, which was in a Christian country at one time was considered an act of treason. And so if they found that you were a heretic, they found that you were a treasonous, and then they would execute you. And it was to mitigate the harm that came from kings killing their enemies that the church actually got involved with that. But I think we're on our way to the market now.
Yeah, let's go to the market. And worms.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
Too busy talking to do a talk radio show. Meow!
Yo!
The Freedom Fiends are back from the market. And I think before we left, I might have been talking about the Inquisition and how the church in Europe got involved with that. Because even though the people thought at that time that everybody in a country had to be the same religion, And I don't know, maybe they, I guess they really believed it. We figured out that they don't have to be now. We can actually live without killing each other. But they thought that if you were, yeah, if you were a heretic, you were a traitor, and the punishment for that was execution. And the idea, you know, very quickly got abused, because we know how people are. You, if you can kill somebody for being a heretic, well, then accuse them of being a heretic, and maybe you can get their stuff, or maybe you can kill your enemies. And this started happening, you know, all through Europe. And the church actually originally stepped into this void and said, this is crooked. You know, you guys are just thieves and murderers, because these people aren't necessarily heretics. These people are just your victims. And besides, you're way outside your competence, you kings and nobles, as to decide who a heretic is. We're the church. We'll decide who the heretics are. And, and of course, they had a point, because that was their area of expertise. And right. So the church actually took over the function of deciding who was and who wasn't. And they did save a lot of people, because when someone would come in, even if they did were a heretic in a way, they'd say, well, perhaps if we instructed you and you said, yeah, I was wrong, you know, people would actually, they did that. A lot of people recanted because they didn't want to get burned at the stake or whatever was going to happen to them. And a lot of, before that, a lot of these people were just being killed anyway, because nobody cared about them being a heretic. They just wanted their property or wanted them dead for some other reason. So anyway, the church got involved with that. I think they totally ought not have been. I don't see, even if you come at something with good intentions, whenever you get in and start mixing it up with the government, you get involved with them, you get dirty. You always get dirty. And anyone will be corrupted, you know, who gets in and starts mixing it up with the state. You mentioned Hugo, I think. You kind of have a similar thing with that, with what, slavery did you bring up?
We were saying before that sometimes, you know, they a broken clock is right, is has the correct time twice a day. So sometimes this happened, and sometimes it would be convenient for you to be tried by the church or by a church tribunal instead of a civil tribunal. And this was the case with slavery. When the conquistadors came to the Americas, and particularly where there were large civilizations with large populations of natives, they sought advice from the church, because probably they wanted to slave the natives there.
You mean the Spanish, and the conquistadors asked the padres or something? Okay.
Yeah, not really. The padres were. Actually pushing for the cause of the natives being labeled pagans. That's people who don't know the word of God. They have not rejected the word of God. They only don't know it. They have their idols. That's what they would say. But they have not rejected the word of God. You know.
So are you saying the padres did not want the Indians enslaved?
That's correct. The padres did not. The missionaries were lobbying, if you will, for the natives, and they actually got that passed. And the natives, even though they were living under very difficult conditions, they were stolen from, and they were they had a bunch of problems, but they were never enslaved. And so that's one of the reasons why they brought a bunch of African slaves afterwards. So sometimes you're on the right side of the church justice, and that's only by coincidence.
And slavery, circumcision, the Inquisition.
Yeah,
all of
we're
the
just
first
a bunch of heretics.
Stick around for the second
heretics.
Hour. It'll be fun.
Worms.
Heresy. Worms.
Heresy.
We'll be right back. Are you sick of government lackeys who say you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Estos son los Freedom Fiends, transmitiendo desde el Cañón Iónico, de baja órbita del campo de reeducación libertario, en la cima de la plaza financiera bestial, en el satélite artificial LIPAR 2017, en la región de Alpha Centauri. Los Freedom Fiends están cubiertos por una licencia BIPCOT No Government. Todo el mundo lo puede usar excepto los gobiernos. Aprende un poco más de eso en BIPCOT.org. So, Fiends, we're back.
We're back.
Yeah, we're back. So, are there any libertarian people suffering from libertarian anorexia?
Anorexia.
They're the thinnest of the thinnest of the thinnest of all libertarians.
Man, I think we found the thinnest, guys. He's so thin. Oh, God.
And, you know, I don't know this fellow's name.
I tried to find out.
I don't know who it is that writes this, but there's a blog called The Bionic Mosquito.
I like that name.
And I think it has something to do with... there might have been a newscaster or something that called Ron Paul a mosquito, you know, implying that when he was running for president that he was tiny and insignificant and highly annoying. So I guess a bionic mosquito might be an indestructible but annoying, something like that.
Yeah, I will say as a Ron Paul supporter, I was probably very much a mosquito. Very small and annoying.
Yeah, well, he didn't win, so he wasn't.
It's happening.
It's happening. It could still happen.
Well, anyway, on this blog, and this fellow, whoever he is, and I don't know his name, he's written a lot of things that I very honestly do like, but there's this kind of a controversial article that he wrote May 14th, so it's not very old, it's not a week old, called Bleeding Heart, Thick Milk Toast, Left Wine Spritzer, Libertarians. Now, right off the bat, I'm assuming that is not a complimentary a description of a type of libertarian. And he wrote, I was asked to compile a list of my posts on the above-mentioned topic, that is on the Thick Left Wine Spritzer Libertarians Bleeding Hearts. And so he gives a list of a whole bunch of posts, I guess, through the months or years, where he takes on all of the thick libertarians. And thick libertarians, well, do either one of you guys have a feeling what a thick libertarian is?
So the way I've kind of seen thick libertarianism described, so I guess some people think there's thin libertarianism and thick libertarianism, and thin libertarianism says, you know, the only principle you really need is the non-aggression principle. You know, you kind of balance all of your positions around that principle. And thick libertarian, I guess some people would define thick libertarianism as saying, well, it's the non-aggression principle plus maybe, you know, some other supplementary philosophies. You know, and it depends on who you ask with this too. I mean, different people define it differently. I know Tom Woods defines it a little differently, and so does Jeffrey Tucker. And I don't know that there are really very many true thin libertarians, according to how I've seen it defined by a lot of people, that, like, you know, people just go based off of the non-aggression principle. Does, you know, they base their opinion of any scenario on that solitary principle. I don't think anyone really does that unless they're being obtuse.
How would you not be a thin libertarian, MK? In what way would you not be one?
maybe people who are advocating for policies in government that other libertarians would feel violate the non-aggression principle, or advocating for, just other supplementary philosophies. And a lot of it seems like it's lifestyle kind of based things. I don't know that there's a whole lot of, okay, maybe from Cato Institute, I could see his point with that, but there's not a whole lot of thick libertarians necessarily advocating that the government get involved to push certain social changes. Leveling the playing field, or this author mentions the basic income guarantee. And that's typically the
Matt Zwolinski thing that he was pushing, the professor from California. I think he is the founder of Bleeding Heart Libertarians.
Yes.
And he wrote a number of posts in favor of a basic income guarantee, right?
Right.
And what did he say about that? I don't remember now. What did the Bionic Mosquito say?
He was not for that. So he believes that it's a rejection of the non-aggression principle. He doesn't believe that it's something that economically makes sense. So they would have a more, conservative view of economics. And I haven't read a whole lot of Zwolinski. I've kind of seen his name associated with trying to advocate for a libertarian basic income guarantee, but that's hard to do without the state. I do believe he is a minarchist, so he does believe that the state should be involved to a degree in pushing libertarian ideas.
You know,
so
I think
that's sometimes a distinction with thick libertarians. That's what I've mostly seen thin libertarians say, but I don't know that it always has to be advocated by.
Well, I'm not sure.
State.
I mean, listening to you, I mean, on other fiend shows and that, I mean, I've gotten the impression that you are actually a very thin libertarian. And maybe we're not defining it the same way. But I guess what I would ask you to see if you were a thin libertarian or not is not whether you think there are a lot of other things that are important, like if you're against racism or patriarchy or in favor of feminism or I don't know, you know, other things that could make somebody thick. My question to you that I would think would distinguish you from being thick or thin is whether you are willing to bring government violence to bring about these other things that are important to you as a thick libertarian. And if you say absolutely not, then I would say you're not thick, you're thin. Because who doesn't have myriad of issues around themselves that they don't think are important? But if they're not willing to force anybody else into their program, in my book, they're thin.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's one way you could define it. I don't have as much of a problem with some of the thick libertarianism stuff I've read. It does tend to be a little more left-leaning, I would say. And in the case of Bleeding Heart Libertarians, they do advocate for state intervention. So I think that is a good distinction to make with Bleeding Heart Libertarians, and that's why he's criticizing it in this article. I think his criticisms are mostly good. I've read a little bit of things on the side. I think Another discussion that this kind of came down to, or I saw people kind of breaking it into, was libertarian brutalism versus libertarian humanitarianism. You know, with the brutalism being more the thin libertarian side of things, and the humanitarianism more of the, I guess, thick libertarianism. And I think a lot of it just comes down to semantics and just how people choose to talk to other people about these
right
kinds
about
of ideas.
That. Yeah.
You know, yeah, like I think
I agree.
I like to be civil, for example. Like, I would like to live in a civilized society where you treat each other with respect, and, you know, or maybe not respect, but, you know, you don't necessarily be a jerk to someone upon first meeting them just because they may disagree with you on some philosophic principle. You know, try to understand where they're coming from, maybe take time to get to know them. I mean, I'm also not a very for PC, though, either, so some people might try to claim me as a thin libertarian. I could see that. Like, I'm not for censorship. I'm, you know, for being brutal if it calls for it. I mean, I've written some pretty, I guess, brutal articles about other libertarians. You know, I'm just as guilty. So.
Well, you say that you're not PC, But if someone were to, I know that you're not a racist, and if someone were to come up to you and start using racist terms, no, you would not want to invoke the state, you know, to punish them. But you would strongly disapprove. You might shun them. You might get after them or something. But I don't think that would make you a thick libertarian. The other thing that you mentioned, you're right that most of the thicks are the Bleeding Heart Libertarians. And that is a website. They are lefties. I mean, it seems like they're always scheming somehow, some way that they can push the non-aggression principle, at least push the curtain out of the way just enough to steal your stuff, you know. But a lot of the there can be right wing or conservative thicks also. You know, you think of the agenda of you know, different churches and things that they would, whereas you or I might not, you know, punish somebody or bring the state power in because they were selling Playboy magazine at the store. Do they still sell it at the store? I don't know. When I was a kid,
What's a magazine?
What's that?
Yeah, what's a magazine?
but they might. But the thick libertarian on the right might have some view that maybe that's their exception. That well, we should work this stuff in. And you're right. That gets into minarchy. I mean, you have to bring back the state if you want to use violence against people. When they, you know, haven't used it against you. So, you know, it can come from both sides, but I tend to see it from the left. And I think that it's just, every time I see it, I'm just thinking, these are just socialists that are trying to get their agenda in. They're like, they're trying to horn in on libertarianism. And, you know, there are some people that are not that, you know, I mean, there are people that call themselves left libertarians. And, you know, like one guy that is a very leading left libertarian, I think, his name is Roderick Long. And I know he's been around for a long time and claims the name left libertarian and that. But I've read a lot of his stuff, read it closely, and he does not want to take your stuff. He backs off all the time from the state power doing it. And so
Roderick is pretty sound.
Yeah.
Roderick Long is pretty sound.
I wouldn't group him together with, say, this Matt Zwolinski, you know, with the basic income guarantee, even though both of them would probably say, yeah, we're left libertarians. I don't think their definitions would mesh.
Oh, look more into this, because he goes after a lot of organizations, too. He can kind of go into that. Because, man, he goes after them, so check out the market, though.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Coming back, talking about thin and thick libertarians
and left and wine spritzer libertarians. I don't know what those are. I really don't. But milk toast, I know what that means. And we were talking, I think, about, you know, the Bleeding Heart and, you know, what the different, I think you made a point, Hugo, during the break maybe in that just because you have some values in your life other than the NAP, the non-aggression principle, that doesn't make you a thick libertarian. And I think, you know, I was agreeing with you saying that the non-aggression principle is such a thin reed, no one could possibly live their life by it. Because it's a least common denominator of conduct. It's the lowest level of conduct that you can have before we descend into the beasts. and so everybody everybody needs a lot of values around their life, and no one's going to be limited just to the non-aggression principle. And our point was that you wouldn't, as long as you didn't force the things you thought were important on other people. Like, I don't know, how about being nice to animals? Would you force somebody to do that?
Exactly. That's one of the best examples. Actually, recently we had an incident in a bullfight of all things here in Mexico, and a bullfighter got really, really badly injured. And there was, you know, whenever some of those things happen, people start with their opinions all over the internet. And I think most of us would agree that it's a good thing to treat animals better or treat them
humanely,
treat them well, with dignity. Even though I eat animals all the time, but I would prefer them to be killed in a more humane way, or whenever I can make sure of that, I do. And that doesn't make me a thick libertarian. It's just something that I enjoy. That you could say it's aesthetic. Not an ethic thing, but just aesthetics. Okay, maybe it's that. But the most important thing is that you don't start using violence. I would be against legislation being passed to, you know, put you in jail if you hit your dog, for example, and that would make me a thin libertarian. I don't want the state to be meddling in those matters. However, I would shame and shun someone who abused their dog. And I don't know, I would post on Twitter or just, you know, expose this person as publicly as I could. And there's, if we don't go to violence for our first strategy, there's a whole bunch of things that we can do, you know. The most typical one is shunning, but there's, you know, we live in a connected world. People pay consequences for their actions without violence.
Right. Well,
how about the animal cruelty is an interesting one. I agree with that completely. But then I say to myself, I'm walking down the street in Libpaire, and I come upon some person who's not merely abusing a dog. Maybe I see them kick it or something, but they're actually torturing it. They're cutting off its leg with a knife, okay? I catch them in the middle of torturing an animal. What do I do as a good, thin libertarian? I'm thinking to myself, I'm probably going to go up and be lucky if I don't get the knife away and stick it in him. Now, I'm not sure if that makes me thick. I tend to think that in Libpaire, I probably would not be perfect exactly as I'm not now. And so if I was in that situation, I might do something. I don't mean I'd kill the guy, but I mean I might do something physical against him.
Let's say punch him in the face. I would be a thin libertarian if I punched this guy in the face to let the dog, you know, be rescued or go. You know, someone should appropriate this dog away from this guy, this terrible guy. And which I am, a thin libertarian, the only thing that that means is I would accept the punishment. Let the guy later on, a couple weeks, punch me back in the face. But I think that's worth it, saving a dog and getting punched in the face.
Can I sit on your jury to help judge you?
Yes, please.
All right.
Back to the market, huh?
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
For some reason in this country, and in a bunch of Western world, it's okay to just judge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created Fiend Phone. I'm using Fiend Phone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about Fiend Phone.
Fiend Phone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try Fiend Phone right now at fiendphone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve Fiend Phone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to fiendphone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's fiendphone.com, F-E-E-N-P-H-O-N-E.com. Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, phone.com.
Fiend Phone. I never knew remote audio could be this good.
And the Freedom Fiends are back. Back from the market. And before we left, I think we were talking about animal cruelty, MK and Hugo. And I'm not sure that we've exhausted that. I think we were talking about, well, what happens if you violate the non-aggression principle when you see something that is just seemingly justified to stop it? Like if you came across someone torturing an animal, who would have no, animal has no rights, particularly in a stateless society. And yet, I said, and I don't know if you guys probably agreed with me, that you might commit some level of force or violence to stop an animal from being tortured, right?
Right. I think you can. I think you have to have your punishment meted out to you.
Yeah, and another example of that, of course, is, you know, you're freezing and starving in the woods, and you come upon a private cabin, and you, to save your life, you break into the cabin, eat the food, and start a fire, trespass, things like that. And most people would say, well, I'd do that to save my life. And I think your point, Hugo, was, yeah, I'd do it, but then if I was going to be punished or have to pay damages for it later on, I'd be willing to do that too.
And yeah, that's true. It's just like when you get into a fender bender with some car and the owner isn't there, you leave just a note with your phone number. It's just the same with a cabin. You just leave an IOU and get that sorted out later.
But the cabin, though, is deliberate. The auto accident is not. You would have to make the decision to actually violate this person's right. Now, with the cabin, I'm not sure if it would be that way, because there are certain legal theories, you know, that you can kind of run with. One is implied consent. Like the owner might say, well, yeah, if somebody needs to get into my cabin to save their life, I don't have a problem with it. But if they're going to tear up my cabin, break the locks, and cost me money, I'd like them to pay me for it anyway. But I wouldn't consider it a crime against me, because I think that there would, like I said, what we'd call an implied consent, that you do certain things to save your life. Lifeboat situations don't always conform to everyday life, and it's better to form your laws, like the NAP, on the way that 999 out of 1,000 human actions, you know, can be ordered by, I think.
Yeah, right. Some people make the mistake of, you know, seeing those edge cases or corner cases even, and then trying to invalidate the whole theory based on those.
Yeah, and you can probably invalidate most theories or systems if you want to take it to, you know, a ridiculous edge. My point sort of was, though, well, don't violate, take it all the way to the edge if you want. You know, punish me for breaking into the cabin, punish me for punching the guy that's torturing the dog because I hit him. Go ahead and punish me for it. I would gladly just subject myself to the society standards, the perhaps the jury of my peers, and they can decide what my punishment will be. In the case of the cabin, I hope I would just immediately say, here, I'll pay for every damage. And in the case of the dog, I guess I'd probably be saying, you're lucky I didn't hit you harder. I don't know. They could do with it what they wanted.
And you could play with the system, even in a hypothetical lay pair. Let's say take the dog example again, and let's say of course after stopping the owner who's beating the dog or cutting its leg, then you gotta steal the dog at some point because you don't want to take it back to the owner. So he takes you to court and he says, okay, he owes me a dog, and you'll say, okay, how much is your dog? You cannot possibly claim that the dog is worth $1 million. So let's say, I don't know, $1,000. Okay, I'll pay you $1,000, you'll never get your dog back.
He couldn't claim that he had much of an emotional attachment to a dog that he was torturing, could he?
Yeah. I think he wouldn't have a case. So you can play this system even in lib pair.
Right. I think it'd be actually less tolerant in lib pair than it is now to fight dogs, for example. You kind of hear about these dog fighting cases with football players or something like that. Who is that guy? Was it Michael Vick? Mixing up my sports balls. But so he's caught like actually fighting dogs, which is a really vicious, horrible thing to make dogs do, and it scars them for life, and it's just really, really messed up. And he basically got a slap on the wrist and was like, whatever, and probably went back to fighting dogs or something.
What do you think would have happened to him in a stateless society?
I think there might have been more violence, possibly. I mean, maybe not. I think maybe there might have been people intervening, stealing the dogs from him if they found out. Oh, something that could be good to not, maybe involve yourself in is maybe videotape it discreetly from somewhere, like get evidence that this dog fighting is going on. And then if there's a threat management in your center, in your area or something, I mean, some kind of, I hate to use the term police force, but there would be some kind of security force, I would think, that, would probably be around to check it out.
I'm wondering,
I think people might just take matters into their own hands even more so, because I think there is that kind of fear now of the state of interfering too much, because you just it's going to be a big hassle if I get involved, because then the state could be coming after me for something too, or there's sometimes a hesitancy to get involved in certain situations because of that fear.
Well, yeah, and you hate to stick your nose into things you don't know exactly
despite all the evidence, people actually believe that the state gives justice, and for that reason, let's say in a stateless society, people don't believe there is this central authority that imparts justice. So let's say there is some kind of tribunal who gives this guy some kind of punishment, and people don't think that punishment is enough. So that would be there would be a difference, because right now you don't have the credibility of, this is the one true court, and there's nothing else we can do.
Yeah, and I don't know if there might be a difference between punishing somebody for torturing a dog and physically preventing them from doing it. I guess whatever it would be, whether you caught them in the middle of it and physically stopped them from doing it, or if you just discovered that they did it, after the animal was dead and you couldn't do anything for it, and if you tried to drag them before a court or something, I'm not sure if you could do that. But once again, it probably would come down to the standards of whatever town you were in or your particular society. Now, abuse a dog. Now, what if you came across somebody who was circumcising a dog? Okay, I'm mixing the first hour with
there
the second hour here. I meant to do that because this is something like the child and the circumcision from the first hour. Are you allowed to just stick your nose in any situation because it offends you personally, even though perhaps it's not a dog being tortured, maybe it's an infant being circumcised?
I think if there's like a credible I think that there's credible evidence that physical violence is taking place in a situation, then yeah, you might have to involve yourself on some level just to balance out the force. But it's often unwise to do so. Say you come across, you know, some people fighting on the street and you're not really sure if violence is taking place. Should you antagonize them more? I think that's a really bad idea. Should you involve yourself in a physical altercation? You know, even that's tricky. You don't know who initiated that. I don't know, but people who do stuff like that, just it's bad decisions, bad choices, bad life choices. But I do want to say one thing about the animal situation. You know, and this isn't, you know, maybe the most popular thing to say, but sometimes there aren't going to be very clean solutions to these problems in a stateless society, just as there aren't in a state society where you have a state that sometimes, like you were saying earlier, Hugo, the broken clock thing, you know, sometimes they do catch a bad guy, sometimes they do it right. That doesn't validate the rest of the system, but sometimes they do things right, and sometimes things slip through the cracks. And I think you'd have the same thing. The thing is, you're never going to eliminate bad people. There's always going to be bad, selfish, brutish, you know, people walking around with brain stems, you know, that can't, you know, get past that certain level of thinking. And you're going to have a degree of violence in any kind of society you have. And you can use philosophy or you can use social order to kind of reduce that violence as much as possible. But, you know, sometimes people might get away with fighting dogs or even torturing dogs or people. And it's not always a clean, easy solution. But I do think if you did have a foundation such as the NAP, along with something like the DBAAP, is what I'm calling it, which is don't be an a-hole principle, then I think that you'll have more stability and more peace. And, you know, hopefully people can get to that level. But yeah, you know, maybe there's not going to be a clean, easy solution, but
there's,
I think we've progressed a lot so far. If you look back at history, I mean, I think people are becoming more peaceful. You know, there's still a lot of work we got to do, especially with the wars and, you know,
I think, yeah, you know,
but
the difference between the stateless society and what we have now is that there will always be these horrible people who want to steal and rob and kill and maim. But in the stateless society, they wouldn't be elected for anything. You know, they wouldn't be marching with an army, and they wouldn't be, yes, you know, they wouldn't be given titles and crowns and, you know, respect.
That would be all because those nobody things would be elected for anything.
Yeah, precisely because of that.
Nice.
Yeah, so yeah. We're not trying to make it perfect.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, that it's a very good principle to live by. I think people can be reductive in thinking about it. I've seen some very kind of, I call it basic thinking in regards to the NAP from, I guess, what they've been called, the libertarian brutalists. So we can talk a little bit more about kind of the other side of the coin with this, you know, what happens when you reduce a principle down to this very narrow worldview. So after
let's
this
do that.
That's heresy, MK.
Heresy.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Meow.
Meow.
Talking away on the radio.
Freedom fiends.
Yeah.
We haven't said something that we usually say, and we have to say it at least once an hour.
You do gotta say it.
Yeah. Obama is a liar and a socialist, and his feet stink. And so is the president of Mexico. They're all socialists, and they all have all stinky feet.
They're all a bunch of socialists. So,
but in Mexico, they're honest, right? Because they don't they call themselves socialists?
Well, a part of, you know, those socialist international party organizations, the international socialists. I don't know how you call it, but they're members of them. They're not ashamed to say it.
So they wouldn't be as big a liar then, if they were willing.
Yeah, well, they're socialists and they have stinky feet. Truth tellers.
Yes.
Right. I'd be happier if our politicians were a little more honest. For the socialists that they are.
That would be nice.
Might not even care so much about their feet then.
That's right.
We gotta find some redemption in the third act now, right?
Yes, MK.
We do. So, I did kind of want to talk for a second about some libertarians that tend to take the NAP to a very odd place philosophically. Like, they'll make the argument that as long as some kind of action is not a violation of the non-aggression principle, like physical, you know, aggression wasn't committed on someone, that the behavior is okay or even like ethically sound. So an example would be you share some private information with someone and that you share in confidence, that there's not an explicit agreement. You don't sign a contract, but there's an implicit agreement of trust. This is someone that you are good friends with, and you share this very personal information that you wouldn't want anyone to know, especially not people who would be your ideological enemies. And this person, you have a falling out with this person, and they decide to share this information with someone who doesn't like you, who maybe even hates you, as a way to ruin your reputation. And it kind of depresses me to see some of the libertarians arguing on this topic recently, I would say over the past week or so, saying, well, that's maybe not the best behavior, but it's not a violation of the NAP, so it's okay. Or maybe that person shouldn't have been so irresponsible to trust that other person with such intimate details. And technically, I think that's crap.
Technically, though, it's not a violation of the non-aggression principle.
Yeah, technically,
but it's a terrible way to live. I mean, what a horrible person you would be if you did that.
Well, right. It's a total violation of trust, and it's wrong. I think any civilized society wouldn't put up with that behavior, and I wouldn't want to live in a society where I couldn't trust anyone because they might share personal information of mine. That's not a place I want to live, and that's the world that some I would say a very small section of libertarians, you know, think that's okay. But thankfully, I would say the larger, you know, libertarian movement, whatever you want to call it, you know, are pretty accepting. They want to reach out to people and do the right thing. And in this article we were talking about earlier by Bionic Mosquito, he's criticizing bleeding heart libertarianism and thick libertarianism. And he posted some articles from the Foundation for Economic Education, which I really like FEE, by the way. They have a lot of really good resources. And he posts an article disagreeing with this article, but I found it very agreeable, specifically one part in it. And it's an article by Max Borders. And he's quoting from a book called The Righteous Mind. I'm just going to change one word in it because I think it's just a little bit off. The word that I'm changing is I'm changing morality to tribalism. And this is kind of what I think when I see these kind of libertarian feuds and fightings, and even like fighting status, is, if you want to use that term, fighting people who are on the left or the right political spectrum. And it's from a book called The Righteous Mind, but I'm changing it. So tribalism binds and blinds. It binds us into ideological teams that fight each other. Sorry. The fight each other, so the fate of the world depended on our side winning each battle. It blinds us to the fact that each team is composed of good people who have something important to say. And I think we should approach things in good faith and try to be peaceful with people to open up the communication.
Hard to disagree with that. Worms, MK.
Worms.
Worms. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys.
It's an awesome show.
It's been a good show, yes.
And that's the Freedom Fiends for tonight.
Lombrices.
Yes, one more time.
Meow.